Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger, and today with us we have Brandon Bott, the best-selling and award-winning author, blogger, and speaker who serves as content director for Bishop Robert Barron's Word on Fire Catholic Ministries. Brandon was one of the millennial nuns when it came to religion until, as a mechanical engineering student at Florida State University, he began a passionate search for truth. That search led him unexpectedly to the Catholic Church in 2008. In 2013, he started StrangeNotions.com, the largest site of dialogue between Catholics and atheists. Today, we'll be talking about his new book, Why I Am Catholic, and You Should Be Too. Welcome to the show, Brandon.
Hey, Pete. Good to be talking with you, buddy.
Awesome. Well, before we start, Brandon, I just have to say, having you on my show has been on my bucket list for some time. And long before the name The Catholic Book Blogger became known, I had this funny idea to review Catholic books. And I got that idea from reading your work on your blog. And when I had that idea, I reached out to you. And you were gracious enough to take some time and hook me up with some publishers. So I want to thank you for that, because if it had not been for that, we wouldn't be talking today.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that, Pete. You're a great book reviewer, way better than I am. So I'm glad you took up the mantle of reviewing Catholic books. You're great at it.
Thank you very much. So let's start with, before getting your book, I want to start with your conversion story itself, because I'm a convert as well. I converted in 1996. And I always enjoy hearing conversion stories and sharing them with others. So I was wondering if you'd share yours with us.
Well, the short version is that I was born and raised Protestant. My family went to a Presbyterian church ever growing up. We were involved with the youth group. And so we were a typical suburban Christian family. But my faith never really stuck. There was never really a personal devotion or personal encounter to Jesus in my early upbringing. But then I went to college, and when I went to college, I fell in with a Methodist campus ministry, which was kind of located right by my dorm at Florida State University. And for the first couple of years of college, all I did was just show up on Sundays, listen to the sermon, and then went right back to my dorm. But eventually, I got invited to join a small group Bible study in this Methodist campus ministry, and I met a group of guys who kind of took me under their wing, and they discipled me. They taught me how to pray, how to read the Bible. They helped me fall in love with Jesus, and it totally changed my life. I had a profound conversion to the faith and became an on-fire Christian. I was even exploring perhaps going to seminary, to a Protestant seminary, to become a Methodist minister. But then my senior year of college, through a wide variety of circumstances, I started looking into Catholicism. The woman who I ended up marrying, my now wife, was born and raised Catholic. And so she was the instigator that got me at least looking into it. And so I started reading tons of books. I started talking to lots of people. And by the time I was a senior, just a couple weeks before I graduated, I had decided that the Catholic Church was true. I looked at the church of the first few centuries and realized this church is far closer to the Catholic Church of today than anything else. The church was hierarchical, sacramental. It was Catholic. And so I knew that I wanted to become Catholic. So just a couple of weeks before I graduated, I entered the Catholic Church on Easter of 2008. That's a short version.
Yeah. And coming out, it's always the women in our lives that lead us there, isn't it?
Yeah. Both my now wife and Our Lady, she played a pivotal role too.
So your new book, again, is Why I Am Catholic and You Should Be Too. Great read. And before we get to too much details of that, who did you write it for? Who's your target audience?
Great question, Pete. I'm glad you asked that. I wrote this book specifically with non-believers in mind. So particularly atheists, agnostics, nuns, you know, the people who have no religious identity, former Catholics, anybody who is not Catholic, that's who I was hoping would read and benefit from this book. So I was not primarily writing it for already convinced and committed Catholics. I wanted to help somebody who was disinterested in religion, who dismissed religion, who thought the Catholic Church has nothing to offer. That's the person that I wrote this book for.
Awesome. Now, early on in the book, there's a lot of data right out of the gate, and you discuss what you call the loss-gain ratio. And what you're looking at is those leaving the pews versus those coming into the church. And the number that you give is actually quite shocking. It's like 6.45 Catholics leaving for everyone coming in. So that begs the question, why? Why, in your opinion and why in your experience, do you find what is driving these people away?
Well, in my last book, which was titled Return, How to Draw Your Child Back to the Church, I spent a couple chapters trying to answer that very question, Pete. I was looking at all the surveys, all the data, trying to put together a picture of why so many people are hemorrhaging from the Catholic Church. And there's a couple different answers. There are a couple different ways we could answer this question. One is by listening to the people themselves who have left the church. So we actually have tons of data from former Catholics where surveyors have asked them, why did you leave the Catholic Church? And when you look at those responses, you'll detect a few trends. One is that the most common reason people say they leave the Catholic Church is because they just no longer believe. Now, interpret that however you want. Maybe that means they no longer believe in God, they no longer believe in the church's teachings, whatever, but they no longer believe whatever the Catholic Church is offering. Another second popular group is a number of people who say they just sort of drifted away unintentionally over time. So maybe they went to Mass every Sunday growing up, but then once they went to college or became adults, they kind of slowed down. They only went to Mass once a month or so. And then pretty soon they hadn't been in a while and they realized, you know, I guess I'm not really Catholic. I wouldn't even really call myself Catholic anymore. So they kind of drifted away slowly over time. So that's one approach, is to listen to people and hear what they're actually saying as to why they left the church. However, in my experience, what I found is that really the ultimate reason why someone leaves the Catholic Church is because they've never encountered Jesus Christ in a personal way through the church. They've never met him through the sacraments. They've never met him through the church's doctrine or liturgy. And so there's no real anchor holding them to the Catholic Church. Now, those of us like you and me who are converts who kind of intentionally found our way into the church, right, we are convinced of the church's truth. And for many other Catholics who are raised in the church, they've had profound experiences or encounters with Christ through the church. And so for us, we can only give the answer that Peter gave when our Lord asked him if he would leave. And he said, well, you know, to whom else would we go? Where else would we go? That's how we feel. But for the large majority of people who identify as Catholic, that's not how they feel. They've never had this encounter with Christ. And so there's no anchor holding them to the church, and it's easy for them to float away. So that's kind of how I'd answer that question.
You know, when I was preparing for this interview and reading your book, I stumbled upon a recent Washington Post article, and it wasn't directly written to Catholics, but it was written at religion in general. And the title of that article, which really caught my attention while I read it, was "Want Millennials Back in the Pews? Stop Trying to Make Church Cool." Now, you're a little younger than I am. I'll be 43 next month, but even I see this, and it kind of disturbs me. People are hungering for the faith, not a social gathering on Sunday. And I think sometimes in the church we make that mistake of trying to make it hip and not focus on the sacraments, especially in the Catholic Church, because that's something we offer that others don't have.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it's one I make throughout the book. You know, nowhere in this book about why I am Catholic and you should be too do I suggest that people should join Catholicism because it's fun, it's cool, it's hip, it's trendy. You know, that may be true in some circles, but by and large, it's certainly not true of the church in general. But it's not a good reason to accept a religion or a worldview or philosophy. The reason you should accept any of these things is because they're true. And that's the case I make in this book, that Catholicism is worth embracing because it's true. It's also good and beautiful, but the primary reason is because it's true. Even if other churches or Christian traditions might have better experiences on Sunday, even if they have more engaging music or worship experiences or more compelling sermons and messages, none of them can match this central claim of the Catholic Church to be the true and only church that Jesus Christ established. And if that claim is true, then to whom else would we go?
Right. And, you know, the thing that really got me when I converted, the first Mass I ever attended was a Christmas Eve service that my now wife, then girlfriend, took me to. And I was blown away because I come from a UCC background, and that's exactly what we had, was a Sunday social gathering. And I noticed a stark difference between the two church services. There was reverence of the Catholic Mass. There was, because of the Eucharist. And that's what I really fell in love with.
Yeah, and I mean, to be sure, the Catholic Church has all forms of liturgy. We have extremely high masses, we have low masses, we have community gatherings, all in between those two extremes. But I'm with you that I think the Catholic liturgy offers something different that's not found in most evangelical services today, and it's something that I think appeals especially to young people, because if all you're doing is playing the entertainment game where you're just trying to provide the best and most engaging and entertaining Sunday experience possible, churches can't win at that game. I mean, you can go to any other secular venue, to a concert, to a sporting event, to a TED Talk, and you could find far more engaging or entertaining activities. So if that's the game we're playing, we're going to lose. What we should be doing is focusing on what the liturgy is supposed to be, which is a reverent encounter with Jesus Christ. That's something you can't find anywhere else.
Exactly. So with that, we're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media, and we'll be right back. Let bad coffee leave you bitter. Experience the pure taste of artisan small batch coffee with Grim Bean Coffee Company. Grim Bean's whole bean and ground coffee is sourced from 90 farms across the coffee belt, from organic, fair trade, and direct trade farmers. With over 20 coffee selections, Grim Bean is sure to match your taste. Single purchase and subscription services delivered to you ensure that you will never be without your favorite coffee again. Visit GrimBeanCoffee.com today for 10% off your order with the code BREADBOX at checkout. Experience the best with Grim Bean Coffee Company. Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. Today we're here with Brandon Vaught talking about his new book, Why I Am Catholic and You Should Be Too. And Brandon, you break the book into three parts, and essentially you're discussing what I would call three pillars for being Catholic, those being truth, goodness, and beauty. And I'd like to get into each of those, but before we do that, how did you settle on these three pillars?
Well, you know, I've always been sort of drawn to the intellectual life and philosophical arguments and things like that, but I know a lot of people aren't, that's just not their thing. And so I wanted to provide alternative pathways for someone to find the church compelling. And so in the book, I lay out three general paths: by finding the church's goodness, by finding the church's truth, then the church's goodness, then the church's beauty. And I think each of these can be sort of avenues or runways into the church. Maybe someone is more aesthetically minded, they're more artistic, maybe they aren't really drawn to the philosophy or the intellectual arguments. Fine. I think the beauty of the church can be just as compelling as those other things. So I wanted to provide multiple avenues for someone to become attracted to the church.
And let's go to the first one that you talk about a lot is the science, the truth, and the faith. And one of the things that I always keyed in on was actually a mental picture that Steve Hemler gives in Reality of God and some talks he gives, and that's that the universe, he relates it to kind of like an old-style radio with 20 dials, and all of them have to be set just right for everything to work, for the channel to be pulled in. So he boiled it down to this simple form that someone has to be setting the dials to make all this around us work, which is a pretty good analogy. So, you know, how do we explain that to people so that they get it?
Yeah, that's a good question. What you're referring to is typically known as the argument from fine-tuning, and Steve Himmler does a very fine job outlining this in his book, The Reality of God, and many others have written and spoken on it too. I didn't include that actual argument in my book because I find that it can be a little difficult for people to grasp, and it's a little tenuous because it relies on current scientific findings. And so in my book, I actually outline three more philosophical arguments for why God exists. In other words, good reasons to believe in God. The first one is an argument from the universe. I look at the universe, and all of us can do this, and you can recognize almost immediately that the universe is contingent. What do we mean by that? We mean that it doesn't have to exist. Or at least it doesn't have to exist as it does right now. It can exist in some other form, in some other way, at some other time, in some other configuration. So it's contingent. However, if that's the case, then it doesn't explain itself. All contingent things require an explanation for why they exist the way they do. You know, for example, if I have my – I'm sitting here with my iPhone in front of me. It's a black iPhone 7, I think. You know, I could ask, why is my iPhone this shape? Why is it this color? Why is it designed in this way? Well, because there's an explanation for those features, those contingent features. However, what philosophers have realized for centuries is that that string of contingent explanations can't go all the way back infinitely. Otherwise, you'll never explain the thing that's in front of you. You'll never explain why there is something rather than nothing. And so as I kind of detail in the book, you can move from the contingency of the universe to the conclusion that there must be some cause responsible for this contingent universe, and it must be a cause that in itself is not contingent. And this is what many of us would call God. That's one argument. I also highlight two others. One is the moral argument, which says that all of us agree that there are objective moral facts in the world. Like, for example, that it's objectively wrong to torture young children for fun. And even if someone disagrees with that, we don't say, oh, that's just their opinion that they like torturing young children. No, we say they're wrong. I mean, they're unquestionably wrong about this fact. But if moral facts exist, then we have to ask ourselves, where do they come from? Mm-hmm. What grounds them? It can't be biology. It can't be evolution. It can't be science. It can't just be whatever the majority thinks, because then it would ebb and flow over time. It must be some objective, transcendent source of goodness. And again, this is what we would call God. And then finally, I put forward the argument from reason, which looks at the surprising intelligibility of the world. Why is it that we seem to be able to understand this world with such great precision? Why do our mathematical equations so accurately describe it? Why is it so marked by order and reason? Well, Christians have a great answer, because we think that our God, who is the embodiment of reason, designed this world and imbued it with his own intelligibility. But I don't think there's a good explanation on atheism. If atheism was true, then it would be surprising that the world is so ordered in this way. We would expect a much more chaotic and disordered world than the one we find ourselves in. So that's a very cursory summary of these three arguments, but my purpose is to suggest that there is good evidence or good reasons to believe in God, that Catholics aren't just arbitrarily taking a blind leap of faith that there's some, you know, fairy tale figure in the sky. No, there are good philosophical reasons that have convinced brilliant people up and down the centuries that God exists. And so that's the starting point for the book.
Right. Now, another thing you bring up as an argument is that we need religion. And for you and I, that's an easy concept to accept because we converted. But for those around us that may not have any religions in our lives, that may be a very hard concept to accept. So how do we go about convincing people that religion is a necessity?
Well, one thing I do in the book is I point to the vast number of sociological studies that have correlated religion to well-being. One sociologist said this is actually the most confirmed fact in all of sociology. He says that religion produces well-being. almost any way you look at it, religion makes you happier and healthier. It produces stronger marriages. It produces more, better behaved children. It reduces risks of depression and cancer and other medical problems. So just from a purely pragmatic perspective, I encourage people, if all you're doing is looking to figure out what will make you happier and healthier, give religion a chance, because religion can make your life better. But beyond that pragmatic appeal, I also show how religion is not oppressive, as many people assume. Many people think that religion is stifling, that what we really need is just pure spirituality, but religion adds all these rules and doctrines and dogmas and structures and rubrics, and it just stifles real faith. But what I argue in the book is that religion is just the opposite, that religion is kind of like a referee in a sports game. You know, sure, some people get mad whenever the referee stops the game or calls a foul or throws a penalty flag. But what's the purpose of referees? The purpose of referees is to make sure that the game flows well. The referee enforces specific rules because these rules have been proven over time to create a great game. Like, the rules exist to make the game flourish, and the referees help to enforce that. So I think that's a good analogy for religion. Religion is nothing more than the experienced rites and rituals and teachings and discoveries that over time have proven to make the spiritual life flourish. So religion, you could think of maybe as like the banks of a river. The purpose of the banks of the river is to make sure that the river flows strongly and with great verve. But if you remove those banks, then the river sort of just slows down and becomes this big lazy lake. So that's the point I try to make in this book, that religion is a good thing if you're interested in having a strong spirituality.
Right. And not only that, but, you know, I found that with the structure within the Catholic Church and the faith itself, that if you're not involved in that or practicing your faith, you wander aimlessly like the people in the Old Testament through the desert. It really does structure your life.
Yeah. You know, it'd be like if I came to you, Pete, and I said, hey, you know, I'm really into science, but, you know, I don't want to read any science books. I don't want to listen to any scientific figures from the past. I don't want them to tell me what to do. I'll just sort of figure out science on my own. Well, okay. I mean, you could do that, but it'd be a huge mistake. Why would you willingly ignore this vast tradition that has gone before you that has so much wisdom to share? You know, you can listen to scientists before you that can say, hey, you know, we've tried these experiments and they don't work. That's going to take you down a dead end. And so don't waste your time looking down that path. Instead, here's another path that I think will be really interesting and helpful to you. Well, religion does the same thing. This is what the Catholic Church does. The Catholic Church has 2,000 years of experience. It's an expert in humanity, as one of the popes said. And so the Catholic religion helps you avoid dead ends, and it helps put you on the right path to your ultimate destiny, which is finding happiness in God. And so, again, religion is not stifling, it's not oppressive, it's a great help toward your goal.
Indeed it is. And we're going to take another quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media with my guest Brandon Brock this week, and we'll be right back. back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, the Catholic book blogger, and with us today we have Brandon Vaught, and we're talking about his book, Why I Am Catholic and You Should Be Too, from Ave Maria Press. And we discussed the first pillar that you mentioned in your book, and that is the reality or the truth behind the Church. Now we move on to goodness. And you talk about the Catholic Church having built Western civilization. I personally believe that's true. How might things be different today if it weren't for the Church's involvement in civilization?
Oh, I think if you take the Catholic Church out of history, then the culture today would be unrecognizable. I think the Catholic Church's contributions to Western culture are simply unparalleled. And when we say, just to be clear, that the Catholic Church built Western civilization, we don't mean that the Church is the only institution responsible for civilization today.
Right.
We just mean that the Catholic Church is more responsible than any other source for society as we know it today, especially in the West. And let me give you just a few examples. First of all, science. Most people don't know that science arose through the Catholic Church, that it arose in Catholic institutions, that the formulator of the scientific method was a Catholic cleric. They don't realize that the founders of huge numbers of scientific subdisciplines were also Catholic priests and Catholic clerics. In fact, the formulator of the Big Bang Theory, which atheists often try to pit against religion, the formulator of the Big Bang Theory was a Catholic priest, Father Georges Lemaître. But even more than that, the very conditions which allowed science to arise as a discipline were grounded in a Christian understanding of the world. There's a reason why science did not arise among the Greeks, the Romans, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, in the Far East and the Middle East. Science only arose in Christian Europe, and it's because of a couple things. First, because Christians believed uniquely that God's character was revealed through his creation. And so as St. Paul says in Romans, that you can understand many of God's attributes merely by reflecting on and examining creation around us. So many Christians took that as a call to arms to become natural scientists, to study the world around us, and by doing so, have a glimpse of the order, the reason, the logos that is behind the entire universe itself. Also, the Christian university system made science flourish. It was Christian monks who first established the university system as we know it today. It was monks who created the distinctions between graduate and undergraduate studies, who doled out certificates of completion and graduate degrees, and even set up the liberal education system as we know it. So if you've been to college, you could thank the Catholic Church for that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are several other instances, and I highlight some of these in my book, from economics to law to human rights to the economy, you name it, almost every sub category of Western culture, the Church was heavily involved in, and in many cases was single-handedly responsible with inaugurating.
You know, I find it rather interesting. You mentioned universities, which the Catholic Church obviously had a huge part in, but also hospitals is another example. And isn't that interesting that in recent years we've become oppressed in those two fields as Catholics in some sense?
Yeah, I think it's deeply ironic and deeply lamentable that these two gifts that the Catholic Church birthed into the world are now used as weapons against her. And so that's why in my book I try to correct some of these myths. The Church is not anti-science. The Church is not anti-education or anti-intellect. The Church has been the strongest proponent of each of these things down through the centuries, and it's only in recent years that these accusations have crept up, and I think they're woefully unjustified.
Yeah, definitely. So another reflection of goodness of the Church that you point out is her charity. And you mentioned certain church individuals within the Church that have been good examples of this. You mentioned St. Lawrence, St. Damien of Malachi, St. Teresa of Calcutta, and they're all, you know, great examples of what the Church has done for society as a whole in charitable examples. And St. Teresa is a prime example of that in our own modern time. It's hard to fathom, again, where we would be today if it would not have been for people such as St. Teresa and the others you mentioned.
Yeah, I agree with you, Pete. You know, I list out the fact that the church heals more people, feeds more people, houses more people, clothes more people, educates more people than any institution in the world. And that's not true just today. That's true over the last 2,000 years. The Catholic Church is by far the biggest charitable arm in the world. And that's, I mean, to me, as a prospective convert, that spoke volumes. Mm-hmm. That was attractive to me. I thought, I want to be a part of that. And then when I learned about people like Mother Teresa or Damien of Molokai, I was even more enchanted because I thought, whatever those people have, that's what I want. You know, whatever is compelling them to live with such heroic virtue and sacrifice, I want a piece of that. So the saints themselves, I think, can be a tremendous lure into the church, especially for people that maybe aren't drawn to the intellectual arguments, but are drawn by the character of a good life. That's what the saints offer.
Indeed. Now, we come to the fact that the church is not trendy or hip, and it's really counterculture. And one area of that especially prevalent today is in sexuality. I think we've all heard of the issues that you've covered in the section that we're about to discuss in your book, homosexuality, abortion, contraception, divorce, cohabitation. You refer to this with a subtitle in the section, Love and the Pelvic Issues, which I must admit I sniggered at that a little. To me, it seems now in our times that we are witnesses to the flower power period of the 60s on steroids. What can we do to turn the tide of that?
Yeah, I mean, whole books have been written on each of these topics, showing how the church's view on each of them, the church's teachings are, again, not oppressive or stifling, but in fact, dignified and coherent and charitable. And so I didn't have space to do that in this book. Instead, mm-hmm. what I tried to do is at least offer some general principles for people to see why the church's positions on these issues are not mean, they're not rooted in animus, they're not that way because the church just wants to strip out excitement and love and relationship and all those things. Instead, the church's teachings are rooted in the idea that man was created in the image of God, that we were created with a particular order and a particular end in life, a particular purpose. And in order to achieve that purpose, we align our bodies, our minds, our sexuality, our relationships to that pattern that's written in our bodies. And when you examine each one of these issues, you see how, for example, contraception is out of line with the pattern of our body. The male body and the female body are designed to come together for the sake of procreation. Now, that's just one of the purposes of marriage. It's not the only one. All marriages don't exist only to produce children. And of course, there are many marriages that don't. Nevertheless, that's the intended end of the sexual faculties in a body. And so contraception, by distorting that, by thwarting that function, means that you're living out of line with the pattern and the intention of your body. You suddenly have a disorder in your life. Now, whether you agree with that or not, and if I'm sure there are many opponents of the Catholic Church who wouldn't find that convincing, my goal is at least to show how the church's view on these things are sensible, that it's not just based on the church trying to be mean or trying to put people down or condemn people. The church has good reasons for these teachings. Now, if you don't agree with those reasons, fine. We can have plenty of discussions about that. But I at least don't want these to be stumbling blocks to people taking the church seriously in other areas.
Right. Now, we've covered a lot of ground here, but I think the real game changer is when the rubber hits the road. And all of us know at least one person, be it a family member or a friend, who's left the church. Now, I want to split this into a two-part question. And the first part, it's likely pretty obvious to us that these people really have no inherent desire to return to the church. And we've likely heard them comment as to why they don't need God or his church. So why would we put forth an effort to bring them back? What? Because there's people that I think really want to do that, but are tentative and scared of rejection.
Well, traditionally in the church, people would answer that question by saying that their salvation is in jeopardy. I mean, if you have a gift that will give this person eternal life, but you're withholding that because you're worried about, you know, how they'll respond, or it might be awkward or whatever, then, I mean, that's a great disservice to that person, because mm-hmm. you're putting their eternal jeopardy at risk. It reminds me of, there was a viral YouTube video from Penn Jillette, you know, one of the famous magicians in Las Vegas,
yes.
Part of Penn and Teller. And he's an outspoken atheist, but he filmed this video where he told a little story about how after one of his shows, a man approached him with and gave him a Bible and was trying to tell him that, you know, if you don't repent and accept the Lord, then you're going to go to hell, and I don't want that to happen to you. I really encourage you to read this Bible. And Penn said, not only was I not offended that that man did that, but I shook his hand and I thanked him. I said, you know, I don't agree with you, but I'm so grateful that you care enough about me to make that appeal to me. Because, and this is what he said, Penn, he said, how much do you have to hate somebody to think that their eternal life hangs in the balance, but you're not willing to go and make an effort mm-hmm. to save them from eternal damnation? So that's one perspective. However, what I try to argue in this book and in my other works is that not only by not sharing the faith are you preventing that person from gaining eternal life with God in heaven, they're missing out on gifts right now in this life. It's not only about the next life. This life would be better for them if they entered into relationship with God through His church. God has gifts that He wants to give them in this life. God wants to help make their lives better in this life. And so just as if your friend was sick and you had a miraculously successful cure, you would do everything to share that with them because you know it would improve their life in this life. That's why I think we need to help people who have left the church, not just for the life to come, although that's indeed true. This life, they're missing out on all the gifts that God has waiting for them.
It's an excellent point, an excellent response, and we're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media, and we'll be right back. I'm Pete Sox, the host of Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. Head on over to my show page at breadboxmedia.com and support my show and our work here at Breadbox Media by becoming a premium member today. And we believe it's more about giving than receiving. When you become a premium member for just $9.99 a month, you unlock incredible discounts from our sponsors like Rugged Rosaries, Catholic Books Direct, Lifeboat Coffee, the Mass Box, and the Harrisburg Senators, just to name a few. And it's even better. Every month, Breadbox Media chooses a nonprofit organization to partner with, and 10% of every premium membership is dedicated to that nonprofit. Join the revolution in Catholic media. Become a premium member by visiting my page today. Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. We've been spending the day with Brandon Vaught, author of Why I'm Catholic and You Should Be Too. And Brandon, second question relative to the one I just discussed with you, and how in the world do we effectively do this? We've given the reasons as to why someone should, and engaging in the conversation with a fallen away Catholic or someone who has absolutely no faith at all sometimes can be like walking on a tightrope over piranha-infested waters. How do we stay on that rope and not fall off and get eaten alive?
Good image, Pete. I like that. Here's what I typically recommend is whenever you're talking with somebody who's left the church or someone who has no religious faith or no religious interest, don't make it your goal to get your own point across. Instead, you want to approach the conversation in the spirit of friendly curiosity. So you want to try and ask lots and lots of questions and draw out from the other person what they think about God, Jesus, the church's teachings, all sorts of these things. You want to see if you can hone in on the big obstacles or the big reasons that are preventing them from coming back to the Catholic Church or considering it for the first time. So, for example, you might say things like, maybe they were raised Catholic, but they no longer consider themselves Catholic today. You might say, hey, you know, I know you're raised in the church, but you don't go to Mass anymore. You don't really consider yourself Catholic. I'm just curious, you know, what changed? What happened? Did something push you away? Did your beliefs change? Tell me about that. I'm interested. When you ask questions like this, not only will it gain you valuable information, but you're also able to steer the conversation in the direction that you want it to go. And you're implying a sense of dignity. You're saying, I care about you. I care about what you think. I'm not here just to manipulate or coerce you to fit my agenda. I genuinely want to know your thoughts about faith and spirituality and religion. So that's my general approach. If you want more on that, check out my last book, which is called Return, How to Draw Your Child Back to the Church. And I lay out a whole game plan on how you can lead somebody back to the church after they've left.
Awesome. So Brandon, I want to give you some time today to talk about two of your projects in particular. The first being your website, Strange Notions, where you pretty much engage atheists in discussion. And what's this site all about? And just whatever you'd like to fill us in about that.
Sure. I started Strange Notions about 4 years ago as the central place of dialogue between Catholics and atheists. So I was really interested in this discussion on questions revolving around God's existence, science, morality, meaning, those kinds of topics. But I realized that almost every other place online that discussed these topics was vitriolic, full of venom and sarcasm and snarkiness, and there wasn't a lot of real, serious, fruitful dialogue happening. So I wanted to create somewhat of an oasis online where serious-minded, charitable Christians and atheists could come and discuss these difficult topics. So that was the plan. I rounded up a group of around 30 to 40 Catholic scholars. So these would include theologians, philosophers, scientists, artists, musicians, cultural commentators, and many more. And each of them contribute different articles and videos to the website. But then the real magic takes place in the comment boxes for each of these articles, because that's where thousands and thousands of atheists and Catholics have come over the last 4 years to go back and forth about many of these arguments and topics and try to get at the truth. So that's been our project at Strange Notions. We're trying to arrive at the truth through reasonable and charitable dialogue.
Now I got to ask you, are you aware of any conversions that have happened through your work on the website?
Lots of people ask that whenever I talk about Strange Notions. It's tricky because in the world of online evangelization, it's rare that you hear directly from people saying this is the effect that your website had. You know, so for example, over the years, there's been 3 million unique visitors who have read at least something on the website, but mm-hmm. I've only received emails from maybe 1,000 people, right? So mm-hmm. what happened with those other 2.9 million people? How were they affected? Did it help them? Did it hurt them? Were they ambivalent? I don't know. But I will say that of the 1,000 or so that have emailed us over the years, there have been several atheists and agnostics who have moved much, much closer to Catholicism. We've yet to hear from somebody who's gone all the way from atheism to Catholicism, but there have been several atheists who are no longer atheists who have adopted some form of theism or deism, or a couple have even become Christians, but still none that I know of, at least, that have become full-on Catholics. But that's okay, because with this website, the purpose that I had was to just plant these seeds, and I'm exceedingly confident that these articles and videos have helped many, many, many untold people along the way and we'll just never know the effects that it has until we get to heaven, hopefully.
Right, right. And it's a great site. I'd encourage everyone to go there. It's strangenotions.com. Next project you have, which I'm a part of, I'm a member of, it's an awesome, awesome resource, and that's Claritas U. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, Claritas U is an online membership site for Catholics who want to get clear about their faith. So that's why the name is Claritas, the Latin word for clarity. Mm-hmm. And we focus on hot button topics, so things that most Catholics are nervous or afraid to discuss. So think things like atheism or same-sex marriage or the Bible or transgenderism, all sorts of these topics that when they come up in conversation, most of us just want to avoid the topic or hope, you know, we can somehow talk our way out of it. But I wanted to equip Catholics to be confident and clear when discussing these subjects. So through a series of video lessons and courses and expert interviews and all sorts of resources, that's the goal, is to get clear about these topics. I think right now we have somewhere around 3,000 members of Claritas U, including hundreds of Catholic priests and seminarians and religious. So it's a really fun and dynamic community. We're learning a lot. And anyone who wants to join us can go to ClaritasU, like the letter U, .com and sign up.
Right. And one thing that I have to say, as being someone that is part of it and has seen the videos, you're very serious about this. Because I know sometimes you see these subscription services out there and they're kind of hokey and not really well made. But you've actually gone to the extent of putting a small studio in your home to film these videos in.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I wanted to make this a site that was beautiful, easy to use, high level, high production value. And so that's what you'll find. I mean, this isn't just like a simple free blog with iPhone videos. This is something professional that I think will really help Catholics a lot. So yeah, I encourage people to go to claritasview.com. You can watch a trailer and some samples and get a sense for what it's like on the inside.
Right, right. And I'll back that up and say it is a great resource. So,
thanks, Pete.
You're quite welcome. Any upcoming projects you can share with us?
Oh, well, those are the big ones. I got Claritas U. I kind of tried to funnel all of my time and energy into Claritas U. In the past, I would write books or create video courses and have my hands in lots of different pots, but my goal moving forward is to really pour myself into the Claritas U community and spend most of my time recording videos for those people, for interacting with those people. So that's kind of the forefront project I have going.
Of course, that's when Bishop Barron doesn't have you doing something, right?
That's right. Yeah. Right.
So in closing, where can people find your books, and do you have any closing thoughts?
Sure. So you can find out about the book we've been talking about during this episode, which is titled Why I Am Catholic and You Should Be Too. You can find that book at whycatholicbook.com. So whycatholicbook.com. And then my website is just my name, Brandon Vogt, VOGT.com. And then finally, the site we mentioned there at the end, Claritas U, is ClaritasU, like the letter U, .com.
Excellent. Brandon, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule today to spend with us and talk about your new book. Again, you were a bucket list guest on my list for a long time, and I'm glad we finally had a chance to connect on the show, and I appreciate the time you spent with us today.
Thanks so much, Pete. It's my joy.
And that's all we have time for today. You've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Soxie, Catholic book blogger here on Redbox Media, and until next time, God bless.